So Everett could be considered ground zero for the opioid crisis in Washington, but you can make a pretty good case that the epicenter in all of North America is just next door in British Columbia. Just 5 years ago, overdose deaths there had been holding steady at under 300 a year. It's about the same as car crashes, but then it spiked. Last year, 1,422 people in British Columbia died of a drug overdose. The crisis in Vancouver has given rise to some pretty radical solutions. You might have heard about the city's legal supervised injection site. It's a clinical model with nurses and service providers on hand. It's the type of place that's being planned for Seattle and King County. But this story is not about that exactly. It's about Vancouver's other supervised consumption sites that have popped up recently. The big difference is that they're run by activists, and in some cases, by the drug users themselves. The birthplace of this movement is a patch of scrubby green called Oppenheimer Park.
It's always been sort of a heart to the neighborhood. A lot of activism started here. This is where the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users formed in 1997.
Travis Lupik is a Vancouver-based reporter and the author of a book on grassroots anti-overdose efforts. He says the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, or VANDU, was co-founded by an activist named Ann Livingston.
Ann went around putting up flyers asking drug users to come and meet in the park, and to their surprise, a few dozen of them did. And eventually, that single meeting in the park became the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. It was the first group of active, hardcore drug users who ever had an actual say in drug policy.
We set off from Oppenheimer Park toward the group's headquarters. In the downtown East Side neighborhood, the epidemic is visible all around us. Worn-down people crouch in doorways or shoot the breeze on corners. People mumble offers of drugs for sale as we pass by. On Hastings Street, we head into VANDU's storefront. People inside lounge or doze on mismatched couches. Right by the door is a virtual salad bar of clean needles, tourniquets, candles, everything you need to shoot up. And in the back, in a small room with a wide glass window, is the injection room.
There's three tables, two chairs per table. They have 15 minutes time limit. Nobody ever keeps it.
Hugh Lampkin is one of the supervisors here. He explains how a trained attendant keeps watch and intervenes if someone's in trouble. As he speaks, the attendant hands a large mirror to this wiry guy with a black goatee.
One of the big things is they call it jugging. So you have your juggler at your throat. You know, after a while, it's really hard to find veins on your legs or your arm. So we try to discourage it, but if they want to do it and they're set on doing it, why not give them the tools and the education to do it properly?
The guy with the goatee props the mirror up on a chair, gets down on all fours, and examines his throat closely in the mirror. Moments later, he slips the needle in. Others are using in the same space, either alone or in pairs. Hugh Lampkin says they all have something in common. Nearly everyone here is medicating their pain, either physical or mental. And he ought to know, besides being a supervisor here, Lampkin is also an active heroin user. He's been on and off drugs most of his life, dating back, he says, to a traumatic childhood.
I had an issue where a relative of mine's basically tried to drown me when I was about 8. I did my first suicide attempt a couple of months after that. Then I was unfortunate enough to have a pedophile cross my path when I was about 9 or 10, and I never told anybody.
Lampkin grew up in Ontario before he moved here.
My actual plans for coming out here was to do myself in, where I would be far away from my friends and my family.
You came to Vancouver to end your life?
Yeah.
After surviving at least one suicide attempt, Lampkin found himself one day shuffling down Hastings Street. And in front of a doorway, he saw a collection of people that looked, as he put it, like the kind of people he was used to hanging out with. So he poked his head inside, and he discovered VANDU. Before long, he found himself in a peer support group.
I was telling a bunch of strangers my life story, and it was something I had never done before. And after that, just about everybody came up and either hugged me or shook my hand, and it was like you're in a dish, and the glass comes off the dish, and I could actually see and feel this darkness lifting off of me. it's the most incredible thing I ever experienced in my life. You know, and never been the same since.
Your story, as you've told it, seems like a story of hope and of coming back from the brink. I think a lot of people think the only kind of hopeful story for someone who's addicted to drugs is getting clean and getting into sort of a mainstream life. What do you think about that assumption?
I was wrong. People don't have to be clean to have a good life. It's not about the drugs. It's about people's lives and how they see themselves. You know, that's what it's about.
This may be a hard thing to get your head around. Can you talk about a success story that doesn't end in sobriety? Well, Hugh Lampkin and others here say yes. They say active users can have lives that are meaningful and productive, that are free of hepatitis and HIV, that are not a danger to others, and above all, that are at lower risk of overdose death. According to officials in Vancouver, there has not been a single fatality in any of their supervised consumption sites.
Quite honestly, if you put this up against another service provider where you have a PhD or a psychologist, I would put my money in a place like this.
Vandu looks very different from the officially government-sanctioned site, which is run by healthcare workers. Sites like this one live in a legal gray area. They get funding from government health authorities and have arrangements with the cops. They're accepted as a necessary response to an emergency, but technically still illegal. Travis Lupik, the author, leads the way toward another grassroots response to the crisis, the Overdose Prevention Society, or OPS.
The site that we're about to visit now, it's sort of a hybrid. It's not as guerrilla as the Vandu site, but it does run independently, and it does run without healthcare professionals.
On the way, we pass through an outright open-air drug market, which Travis says has been here for years, long before the safe injection sites. It stretches a full block. It's crowded with people milling about and discreetly transacting or selling secondhand goods. OPS started as nothing more than an outdoor tent with a few volunteers standing by with shots of the anti-overdose drug naloxone. About a month ago, they moved indoors.
So we've basically inherited an open room.
This is Ronnie Grigg, a manager here.
That has a leaky ceiling and two bathrooms, one that works. And then we have 12 booths.
Grigg says places like OPS and Vandu are needed with the advent of fentanyl, a super potent and deadly opioid drug that has all but displaced heroin in Vancouver.
It caused frontline workers to have to leave a clinic facility and to be running up and down streets, alleys, sidewalks. One overdose that I attended to, the police referred to Insight staff as the first responders.
At OPS, the stainless steel booths are all full, and it's all men here. I meet a guy named Darren with that prematurely aged look, eyes sunken, cheeks gaunt, but his hair is carefully combed and gelled, and his clothes look like any other 20-somethings. He agrees to talk and then proceeds to spill his whole life story in about a minute.
I was on the streets using, and my girlfriend, Randy, she had 6.5 months clean, and she pulled over to the side of the road and did a shot, and she injected and died. So I went out pretty hard. And I shoot a lot of heroin every day, and I'm really sad and depressed, and it gave me false self-esteem and took everything away from me. I'm planning on stopping on Tuesday for good, hopefully, this is a great place. Ronnie saved me a couple days ago. I did a shot of meth and I was crying, and these guys really care about you here. They really do. Without this place, people would be dead all over.
Around the corner is another part of OPS. It's an outdoor pop-up awning where people can smoke drugs, opioids, meth, crack. They say it's the only supervised site of its kind in North America. Manning the entrance is a tall, rail-thin guy named Cameron. His story of addiction is an all-too-familiar one.
Originally, I was on medication, pills, and sadly, BC is partially against pills, and I still get the pain, so I had to go to heroin, no choice. Unfortunately.
So you had been like a professional, you had a career and stuff?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I've got an economics degree. Business-wise, I was doing well. $500,000 a year.
When I explained to Cameron what I'm reporting on, he asked me a question. Do you think that these sites are good or bad? It turns out Cameron has mixed feelings about it.
basically it's helping, but at the same time it's allowing people to take advantage of the situation, like, because they know their life is not in danger, or they believe it isn't anyway. So people know that if they go overboard, they can be brought back.
Cameron has attended to his fair share of overdoses, but he says lately he's found the experience really troubling.
I tend to stand outside of the overdoses as much as possible. Whether you see it or not, it does. It affects you when you see somebody that's almost dead and he gets up and then he does it again.
That gets at a big question. Do sites like these actually make things worse? As we wind down our tour, author Travis Lupik says there's data on that question. Several studies of this neighborhood have found that after the first supervised injection site opened, littering, injecting in public, and transmission of disease all stayed flat or decreased.
I mean, we saw a lot of people injecting drugs today, and all of those people were going to be injecting those drugs no matter what. So I think it makes a lot of sense to let them inject them in the places that we visited, where they're getting clean water instead of using a puddle, where they're getting a fresh needle instead of using a dirty one, and where there are people trained in overdose response to catch them if they fall.
One statistic that hasn't turned the corner yet: overall overdose deaths in British Columbia. Again, more than 1,400 people died last year. But the province's chief coroner said if not for these types of harm reduction efforts, the death toll could be three times as high.